meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
All right, good evening. It's going to be a busy night ahead of us. Now, if you've been watching the cable news shows, and in particular some of the pundits, the hosts, the whatever you want to call them, have gone and stepped forward and made predictions about some certain high-profile cases. And I want to go on the record right now that Geraldo Rivera and his producers were invited to the program tonight, and they chose not to attend. One of the high-profile cases we're talking about is former Bolingbrook police officer Drew Peterson. And I have Drew Peterson and his attorney, Joel Brodsky, on the line with me. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Dan.
Good evening, Dan.
When you talk about high-profile hosts like this and Geraldo, I'm going to start with you, Drew, if that's okay. You've said on my program before that you were disappointed with Geraldo, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit that he coached you as far as what to say. You know, you wanted to answer a question one way, and he told you, no, here, this is how you should say it. And it just kind of spiraled down from that to the fact that he's made predictions as far as when you were to be arrested, et cetera, et cetera. Your thoughts?
My thoughts on it is it's all about ratings for these people, and they really don't care what they're doing to an individual's life. The whole system seems to be ratings driven, and if it creates ratings to keep me sinister and keep me looking nasty or guilty, it's about the goal rather than speak the truth. Me being a good, upstanding citizen doesn't sell newspapers.
You've said that before, and I'm not laughing at you. I'm just saying that's a fact when it comes to cable news. Joel Brodsky, attorney for Drew Peterson. Geraldo was very bold in some of the predictions he made. Do you remember what those were?
Well, I think the last prediction he made while I was on a show with him was that Drew would be arrested before the end of August, which obviously didn't happen. He just came up with this number, date out of thin air. And I asked him, I said, well, what are you going to do when you're wrong? And he didn't have an answer for that. And I think that's the problem. Nobody holds him to account. I mean, he's made two predictions that Drew will be arrested by a particular date. Both of them turned out to be wrong. And nobody holds him to account for this. It's wrong. Used to be, I think, if a guy made a prediction like that and it turned out to be wrong, they used to force him to resign. It's a very troublesome thing to have, be on a major media outlet and to say somebody's going to be arrested for a murder by a certain date, and that what it does to the person, what it does to their right to an unbiased trial or an unbiased presumption of innocence. It's all contrary to that, but nobody's holding anybody to account for these Russian roulette type predictions.
And I want to make it very clear that Geraldo and his producers were invited on the program, and at the last minute, they decided not to come on the program. I seem to remember, Joel, that broadcast where you did challenge Geraldo as far as if he was wrong, what would he do, and he just didn't answer the question. Are you and Drew coming out publicly now to ask for an apology from Geraldo Rivera, or his resignation, or what?
Well, Drew, what would you like to see Geraldo do?
Jump off a cliff, maybe?
I'd love to see him come out and take responsibility. Say, yes, I would. He really owes it to both his own listeners and to Drew and to the public in general to come out and take responsibility. And say, look, I'm wrong. I'm not going to make any predictions again. It's not the right thing to do. He really does, and I'd love to see him do it. I'd love to see him take responsibility.
Now, Drew, you said in jest, I'm sure, that you'd like to see him jump off a cliff, but this is a direct I guess I'll use the term attack on you when he predicted that you would be arrested, and it didn't happen. Would you sit down face to face with Geraldo Rivera and accept a response from him if it was an apology?
Oh, sure. I'm an open-minded guy. I'll talk to anybody about anything, but if you get Geraldo in a situation, which is clear, he showed with Joel that when he doesn't know what he's talking about, he tries overpowering you with a barrage of garble, like he did with Joel on one of the shows, and just tries to overpower you with his language, and he talks a lot, but he doesn't say nothing, but he doesn't allow the other person to get a word in edgewise, and that's pretty much his style on this. So some sort of a confrontation with a guy that's an experienced newscaster would be kind of tough.
Right. And you were going to say, Joel?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it would have to, I mean, I'd love to see them get on a news, some sort of situation where I was hoping he'd be on this show because mm-hmm. where he's not in charge, where he doesn't control the when this, you know, who can talk and when. I would like to have that type of situation with him where he's in control of the interview. And he's in control of the, you know, the where the camera points and when the microphone's on and off. It's kind of unfair, but you know, in a broader sense, these predictions are, you know, really get to be troublesome. I mean, every time that Drew and I have we have court on his gun charge, we always get a some sort of media personnel, somebody from the media is calling us and telling us that they got an inside tip that Drew's going to be arrested at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always false, and we laugh them off at this point. But you know, it's trouble. These predictions are really troublesome, and they're, you know, so often inaccurate. And nobody's holding anybody responsible for the inaccuracy of these predictions. And you know, to me, it just seems like there should be some sort of you know, consequences for making a public inaccurate, you know, prediction.
And this isn't just about Geraldo. I want to make that perfectly clear. Although, you've decided to focus on him because he was bold enough to go on his program and actually pick a date. In fact, I believe you guys decided to extend it a little bit before you decided to question him on it. But I want to go back, Drew, if possible, to the very early days of the disappearance of your wife, Stacy. And Geraldo Rivera was one of the first media people that you actually sat down and talked with, or am I wrong?
Well, he called me up a couple times on the telephone wanting to take me for lunch and just talk, and then he showed up at my door when I didn't respond to him. Basically, his celebrity status got him in the front door.
Right.
And we sat at the my kitchen table with my sister and my brother for about an hour, and we talked basically how we both had younger lives, and it was a very cordial meeting. And when he asked me questions about specifics about the case, he goes, well, tell me in your own words. And I'd say, okay, well, this. And he'd say, well, say it like this. And I go, then it's not my own words, but it sounds better, say it like this. And he did that with pretty much every question that he asked me. And then he walked outside, and as soon as he stepped out, we're watching this live on television, as soon as he stepped outside on my front porch, he goes, there's Drew Peterson inside, just talk to him. There's a man feeling a noose around, closing around his neck.
Oh, jeez.
That's what he talked about. It was like a Dr. Jekyll switch went off, and he became a whole different guy. And then when he went next door to Sharon Bartowski's house with all Stacy's family and friends, he talked about people coming over to in my house, and weren't they afraid of being held hostage, and this, that, and the other thing. It really made me look like this sinister, crazy person. When Stacy's family was over at my house, and they were just collecting ashes from that belonged to Stacy's deceased sister.
Right.
So it was like I was doing the family a favor and helping them out, and he's making me look like this crazy person, you know, barricaded behind the house, taking people hostage. It's just like this total sensationalism. For no particular reason other than ratings.
Joel Brodsky, sensationalism, I was just going to bring up that term. A while back, we were hearing lots about wiretap evidence or wiretaps, and I know you made a court appearance here the other day or responded to some media reports on these so-called recordings, and again, that was sensationalized a while back, that was the last nail in the coffin, so to speak, and I'm not trying to be ignorant here. Your comments on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we always suspected that there was some sort of electronic surveillance going on with Drew. I think when Drew picked up his cars, when we finally got his cars, or the court order to get his cars back, I think he when he sat in the car, the TV cameras were on him, he was going testing 1, 2, 3. So it was no surprise to us that there was a that there was some sort of electronic surveillance. And, you know, these tapes the judge confirmed in court exist. We still don't know, you know, if they're just the tapes of the car or bugs that they put into Drew's house or, in fact, that there were wired informants. We just don't know. And, you know, to tell you the truth, one thing that I found very interesting is that the state's attorney doesn't really even know 100% what's on these tapes, because the judge has to review all the tapes to make sure that they conform with the court orders before the state's attorney can get to see them. So, you know, to have people come out and say, get on TV and say we're the source of the tapes and this is what the tapes contain is probably A, inaccurate, and B, counterproductive. You know, where you have responsible law enforcement officers and responsible judges that are really evaluating and looking over these matters. I think the sensationalism of it is ridiculous, especially, like, what did Lenny say, that Drew wouldn't make his September 10th court date because he would be locked up by then?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's another false prediction. Believe me, Once again, he doesn't take responsibility for his false prediction.
And that was on Geraldo's show, was it not?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, having met Lenny once or twice, and I know Drew said this, when Lenny says, arrest is imminent, the man never used the word imminent in his life. You know, so somebody's feeding information. somebody's feeding him his information. I know he's just somebody, kind of instigating what's going on here. I don't know who. Yep. Maybe it's some media personality. I don't know. But
when Lenny was confronting me in the barbershop parking lot, there was media people there, and they seemed to be egging him on into a physical confrontation, too. So, again, trying to get a story where there's really not a story.
Well, you know, and when it comes to this, and we're not here tonight to talk about guilt or innocence, we're here tonight to talk about media sensationalism and some certain media people, in particular Geraldo Rivera, who's made predictions about my guests this evening as far as their arrest and all of that. When it comes to this, Drew, again, we're not here to talk guilt or innocence, but you get lumped into a sensationalized media story. We have other stories about OJ, and there's this poor story of the young girl missing in Florida, the Kaylee Anthony story, and there's all these high-profile cases. I think you can relate to the fact of these people in Orlando with the 24/7 news coverage on your front lawn, the protesters, all of this stuff going on, and just swallows up your life. Your thoughts?
Well, it does, in fact. I mean, even as late as last Saturday night, I had Sharon Bukowski, her goofy son, Melroy, out in front of my house, out in front of her house, and I guess he even made up a song to the tune of London Bridges, and they were playing that in a loudspeaker and laughing and yucking it up and posting signs, Redrum, in the lawn. And I mean, this is all stuff they were doing in front of my children.
Right.
We were coming and going, and I mean, this has to have some effect on them. I mean, it's like, I say I'm an adult, I'm fair game. You want to come say something to me, say it, but they're doing this in front of the kids. And I'm not having any thoughts of the consequences it's having to their little minds. So I think these are some pathetic people.
Joel Brodsky, and you and I have discussed this on past programs, but you may end up in court someday. It's hard to say. We can't predict that one way or the other right now. But this publicity spiral regarding your client has gone 360 degrees every direction, right down to, like we're talking about, predictions from the media to almost a vilification to many media appearances to you name it. How do you handle that as far as the process of being a defense attorney?
Well, I mean, for example, we have Drew's gun charge, the weapons charges,
right,
are going to go to trial in December. We've had to you know, spend a lot of time and money getting a jury questionnaire, you know, of almost 100 questions, and that's just the beginning. And to, you know, to try to weed out, you know, jurors who may have a, you know, a bias or prejudice in the case. And we're going to have to, the judge even indicated, we're probably going to have to go through three or four times as many jurors as usual in trying to pick a jury, and it's going to take a lot of time. And it, you know, why obviously that, you know, the time and expense is borne by the defense to some extent. It's also cost the prosecution time away from other cases, judges' time, deputies' time. I mean, it's a drain on the taxpayers as well as the defendant, and it puts a bias on the system, or, you know, pressure on the system that really doesn't belong there. I mean, you know, I've tried to make my responses, and people will say, well, you know, it's our fault too. We've definitely, you know, Drew and I have tried to pursue, you know, media coverage. But I think when you really look at it, and this was that it, we've always been reactive. In other words, we've only appeared in reaction to some leak or some revelation or some statement. We really haven't gone out in there and been the leaders. We've been, you know, been getting out, and when something comes out, we'll want to get our side out. If nothing had come out, if there was no leaks, if there were no statements, if there weren't trucks parked in front of Drew's house, we wouldn't ever have gone out and gone into on any of the network or cable shows. We were trying to be reactive rather than proactive, and I just, you know, I think that that's the problem. We you know, we really should, people should, there should be some acknowledgement of the effect that this type of extreme media coverage has, both, you know, on somebody's right to a fair trial, and also the cost and the effect it has on the system, which is great. I mean, here we're going to have a simple UUW, or unauthorized use of weapons, charge in the state of Illinois. Usually it would take half a day to try a case like that,
right?
Three quarters of a day tops. Where it's going to go for 3 weeks,
yeah,
and that's only because of the publicity.
And watch,
that's a shame, and it's really a burden on the system that doesn't need to be there.
And watch the media coverage when that starts. Drew Peterson and Joel Brodsky are here. You know, Drew, former police officer, all of these fingers and eyes pointing towards you. You're mad at Geraldo, and there's other media outlets too that I'm sure that you're disappointed in as far as how this has been covered. If you had a chance, and the format of my program is when I bring my guests on, whether I agree with them or not, in most cases, to sit down and actually speak their mind and be fair with them. If you had a chance to sit down with Geraldo Rivera and not have him tell you what to say, what would you do and what would you say to him?
Well, I'd just probably confront him on his threats and stuff. He's threatened to, on occasion, to come after me. He goes, I'm coming after you, and I'm going to get you. And my response to that is, what are you going to do, misquote me to death?
Right.
That's pretty much my biggest fear. He has, like I say, he's a skilled news person, and every time I've seen him be involved in any type of confrontation with anybody, he just overpowers them with rhetoric, which really is saying nothing, but he just talks. And really, in this gun case, I sit there and listen to him, just shaking my head on how much he didn't know what he was talking about. So basically, on even format, I'd like to just set the record straight with him. And I'd really like to know, well, I know why. He's chasing ratings. So, and again, it pays better, and it sells better to keep me sinister.
Joel Brodsky, if that time ever came, and actually I even threw that idea out to Geraldo and his producers. I said, okay, you come on my show, and maybe then the three of us can come on your show, and we can do it all over again, but let's be fair and allow Drew and Joel to speak and get all sides on the table. Would you consider that, because Geraldo didn't want to come on and do that here?
Yeah, I you know, like I said, in a format where he doesn't control the microphone and the camera, yeah, I would love to. I mean, I'd like to talk to him about some of his explanations. You know, they put him on as to he was talking about the gun charge and I was talking about a sawed-off barrel, which is ridiculous, or that a short barrel puts a bigger spread. But we're talking about a rifle, which fires a bullet. There is no spread. I'd like to ask him how he comes up with these type of things. You know, I really would like to. And he says them, as authoritative, and it goes off, nationwide as an authoritative statement, and it's so blatantly wrong. And I just like to understand the process of how this happens. I mean, and if he's wrong, to get him to say, look, I made a mistake. I acknowledge that. My researchers I should fire my researchers or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I would love to sit down with him in an atmosphere where he doesn't have total control over the microphone and the camera, and go over some of these things, because it is disturbing. And to tell you the truth, it's disturbing that inaccurate information and these type of Russian, what I call Russian roulette predictions. If he's right, he doesn't. If he's wrong, he doesn't get called on. And if he's right, he looks like a hero because he predicted it right. I'd just love to talk to him about those situations.
Yeah, and hopefully, I'm pretty sure his producers will be listening. And if he's listening to this, he's heard what you guys have to say. Drew, I'm going to give you the last word.
What would you like me to say?
you can recite poetry, you can sing, you can do whatever you like. I just want you to comment just one last time as far as how you feel the media has treated you.
Well, again, everything's been sensationalized, and I was with a couple of producers early on, talked with them, and they were pretty frank about the system, and I'm not going to tell you who they were, but they said everything is ratings-driven. And just the fact that they were talking to me got their employers to give them congratulations that they were getting the top guy and the top story, and it was, again, all ratings driven. And they look at me and they says, the news world is all about ratings, and it really has no consequences involved to them, on what they're doing to my life. So.
Okay, well, fair enough. Drew Peterson, Joel Brodsky, thank you.
Thank you, Dana.
Okay, we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye. All right. There, I gave them the opportunity. Geraldo had the opportunity. In fact, we were really close, I thought, to having Geraldo come on the show tonight. And he's welcome to any time. And I even offered to be part of a discussion with Drew Peterson, Joel Brodsky, Geraldo, and myself, and that offer is still on the table. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We've got a big show ahead of us tonight. We're going to get an update on the Becca McAvoy case, a sad case of the little girl who was killed tragically on her way to give testimony in a grand jury, and the trial was supposed to start today, September 22nd. We're going to find out where that is. A little bit later, we've got author Craig Glazer will be on to talk about his new book, The King of Sting. And Tim Miller and Leonard Padilla, we've got all sorts of things on the go here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. I sat down earlier today with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla and got an update as far as his involvement with the disappearance of young Kaylee Anthony. All right, we're back. We all know bounty hunter Leonard Padilla as the one of the people behind securing the release of Casey Anthony a while back. He's been a regular fixture on a lot of cable TV shows. Of course, he's been a bounty hunter for over 30 years, and he's always welcome on this program. Hi, Leonard.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Welcome back to the program. Last we talked to you, and since then, there's been lots of breaking news. One of the first things I'd like to ask you is Orange County investigators have been down to interview you, I believe, and some of your...
Correct. And they talked to me and Rob Dick regarding, certain statements that Casey had made.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly the one where she told them that she dropped the baby off at apartment 210.
Right.
And she definitely told us, both myself and Rob, and her own mother a different story. Told her mother the same story she told me and Rob, and that was that she'd gone to the park, and that at the park, Zenaida and her sister Samantha had actually taken the baby away from her and gave her a scripted 30-day list of things to tell the cops, which were all lies.
Right.
And that's why, basically, she had lied to the cops.
Mm-hmm. It's been well established that Casey Anthony doesn't know the difference between a truthful statement and one that will come back and bite her on the rear end. But this story has gone, you know, crazy. Now all of a sudden we're seeing guardian angels down trying to help the family, to the protesters who, to be quite honest with you, I'm getting sick of, because...
Well, here's what happened, okay? Back when we were on the bond.
Right.
We got her out on a Thursday. The thought in my mind up until the following Wednesday, when the results from the Tennessee lab and the FBI's lab came out, which was the following Wednesday.
Sure.
I really, really thought that we had a person that was alive.
Right.
I really did. However, that Wednesday night being old-fashioned, I said, hey, I really believe in the FBI lab, and I certainly believe in Tennessee, so, you know, I got to change my thinking. So the next day, we thought, okay, things are going to get pretty nasty around here. There's no safety features. I mean, you can't really, you know, guard anybody in a house the way we were doing it.
No.
So we said, we're going to surrender her Saturday. People said, well, why Saturday? Why don't you do it now? Well, she had appointments on Thursday and Friday with the attorney. We didn't want to mess them up.
Right.
But by Friday, it had gotten to the point where it was totally out of hand. And law enforcement came in and arrested her on a warrant for some bad checks. And basically got us off the hook. We surrendered to bond, and the following Sunday we're back in Sacramento. Now, if they had left her in jail, I think the threat to the family and the protesters, it would have gone away.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But what happened was that, you know, some people out of Tennessee who have the thought in mind that they can make some money off of this thing by selling appearances at different television programs and things of that nature came into town,
mm-hmm.
and resurrected the activity and got her back out on some bonds. And the next thing is, you've got what you've got out in front of the house, which is what we had predicted would happen if she stayed out of custody. And it's happening now, and the only way it's going to stop is if they put her back in custody.
Absolutely, and it certainly isn't doing anything to help find the baby.
No, it's not.
If you're just tuning in, Bounty Hunter Leonard Padilla is here. One of the questions that came up early in the investigation, Leonard, we haven't heard much about it lately, is the father of the child. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's been, in other words, if you were to believe one party, it would tell you it was Eric Baker out of Kentucky. Another one would tell you it was Jesse Ortiz, who died a couple of years back.
Right.
Another would tell you it was J.B. Platt. Another one would tell you it was her own brother, Lee.
Yeah.
So it's a situation where you can, you know, and then there's also the Marine, Mark Hawkins, and then there's another Army GI by the name of Bernard, or Brennan. Brandon Snow up in North Carolina. So you've got all of these players in there, and until somebody does some extensive DNA testing, I don't think they're really going to know. I don't think she knows, and definitely the parents don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best.
No, it's just an unknown right now.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to explain it. Jesse Grund, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that properly.
He's the only one that was accused, and he took a paternity test and cleared it, so...
Yeah, there is some speculation that the Anthony family is trying to put some blame on him. Do you know anything about that?
Well, how that comes about is he basically bailed out of Casey's life early on.
Right.
He had a real yen for her. I think he still has a great admiration. Well, let's call it love. You know, that first love thing for her.
Sure.
He was on Geraldo the other night, and he described it as being his first love. He'll always have that for her. But he always had this thing for the baby. When the paternity test came back as that he wasn't the father, it affected him adversely. But I think he also stood up to Cindy in such a manner that Cindy just did not like it. And her and the attorney have kind of worked at making him the fall guy in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are situations where, you know, I sometimes have asked his dad certain specific questions about Jesse, and at other times I've wondered, you know, why Jesse even stayed involved. I mean, like, even so far as July the 1st, going to his apartment, she goes to his apartment, and that's a day or two after her car got towed, and she asks if she can borrow the shower.
Right.
In his apartment. I mean, that, you know, that's just strange activity. But this girl is constantly doing strange things that don't surprise any of her friends.
That's so true.
So now they've got this thing about, well, you know, Jesse must have killed the child and stuck her in the trunk of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this whole thing about a dead body in the trunk of the car came basically from the following Thursday. The Thursday after the Wednesday, Cindy is sitting in the RV with me and a couple of fellas outside of her house.
Right.
And we're saying, Cindy, we've been around this business a long time. You've got to face reality.
Mm-hmm.
I says, are you going to try and tell me that somebody stuck a dead body in the trunk of your car? And that's why we have decomposition going on?
Yep.
Come on, stop that. You know, get back to reality. Get your feet on the ground and get this thing solved. Well, the following day she was talking about, you know, her other people had access to the trunk of the car, and somebody probably stuck a dead body in there. And even Casey herself made the comment that a lot of people have keys to the trunk of my car.
Yeah.
A lot of people could have stuck a body in my... I mean, it just went sideways, you know, the whole thing, off of one little statement that we made while sitting there where they're explaining to her, the only way you're going to have decomposition of a human is if somebody stuck a body in there.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been quite vocal about a reward that you're offering. Share that with my audience, please.
If somebody would come to me and say, look, here's where the child's body is, here's... I will pay them $50,000 to tell me where that child is. Not, you know, statements like, well, try Florida, or try the backyard, or try the swamps, or try the ponds.
Right.
I mean, specifically, tell me, and I recover the body, and prove that it's Kaylee, and they got $50,000 cash.
You're one of your people, a female employee, who has come forward and said that, you know, on advice of an attorney, she won't be speaking right now.
Okay, here's what happened. She's not really my employee. She works with us on a lot of these things where we need a female to transport a female or something to that effect.
Okay.
And in working with a security team headed up by Rob Dick, her job was to sit in that house with Casey day and night, ride to the attorney's office, ride to wherever she had to go with the security people, so there was always a female with her. At first, it started out that she was to make sure that no harm came to her while in that residence, whether it was from her dad or her mother or herself.
Right.
As time went on, obviously, you know, discussions take place. I am not privy to most of those discussions. However, unknown to myself and Rob, there were a lot of discussions took place between Casey and her, and when they got back to California and the cops back there said, hey, we want to come out and talk to you, she was concerned that some of the things that she had heard and not reported to law enforcement back there before she left might land her in some trouble.
Right.
Her attorney decided that before it went any further with law enforcement, she should not discuss anything with them, and basically sat here in front of me and told law enforcement, no, she's not going to discuss anything with you other than her name, rank, and serial number.
Sure.
And, you know, what she was, what her job was back there, but she's not going to discuss any specific discussions she had with Casey, because it could land her in a, misprison of a felony or something to that effect. It's an old term, but it does, it's around, you know. A lot of people say, well, you have no duty to, you know, to volunteer information. But in a case of this nature, anybody that would hear something and not volunteer immediately to law enforcement, I think, is a fool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I said that to her, and the attorney, all he's interested in at this stage of the game is making sure that she doesn't get into trouble. And law enforcement was understanding, because, like I said, she hadn't even said it to us. And if there's things in there that I've guessed at, and if they were relayed to her by Casey, if she'd have told me that, I'd have immediately gone to law enforcement with them.
One last question before I let you go, and I appreciate your time.
Sure.
Do you feel, I personally feel that law enforcement in Orlando, Orange County, have enough right now to file murder charges. What about yourself?
Absolutely, they do. You don't need a body. Nobody's ever needed a body. here in San Francisco, they just convicted a gentleman of murdering his wife when they couldn't find the body. And after the verdict came back in as guilty, in order to get a lesser sentence, he made a deal with the prosecutor that he'd show him where he hid the body.
Right.
So that's always in the back of people's minds to keep, you know, at least hold back one chip, you know. And getting back to, you know, some of the statements that might have been made to the young lady that was in there with her, one of the things that happened that Cindy and George are very, very cautious about and have not admitted and actually deny is the fact that the night that Cindy came back from Father's Day and found out that, you know, while up there that Casey had been stealing from the grandparents.
Right.
She literally grabbed Casey by the throat. I mean, literally, mm-hmm. by the throat. And created a pretty loud commotion in that house the evening of the 15th of June. That's why my thinking is that this stuff about she walked out with her baby in the backpacks the next day is a lie. She left that night.
Yeah, and that
he scared the hell out of her.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are more lies than there are truths coming out in this story right now, and I'm sure that, you know, there's a lot more to come. Leonard Padilla, right. I appreciate this.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Bye bye. That's bounty hunter Leonard Padilla. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And we are right back. There's a new book out called The King of Sting. In a nutshell, the story goes like this. While in college, my next guest, Craig Glazer, and his pals pull off 30 stings posing as law enforcement and robbing drug dealers. If you can imagine, you know, that's something that's right out of Hollywood, but it's true. It's an exciting new book. Of course, go to the website. It's posted in our show notes or www.kingofsting.me, and I'm very pleased to have Craig Glazer on the show. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Dana. Thanks for having me on.
Now, when you see, you know, a headline or a lead-in like this about 30 stings posing as law enforcement and robbing drug dealers, you think of, you know, a Hollywood movie. But this happened in real life. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book, The King of Sting, which is my life story, and I co-wrote it because the stories you're going to hear here for a few minutes is, if someone told you this in a bar, you'd have the guy walk away and go, that guy's full of you-know-what.
Right.
It's a pretty, you know, they try and compare books or movies that are true to other stories, and it's really hard to compare this one. I co-wrote it with Sal Mann, a journalist who covered us during all those years, and it does take place over 20 years. Like all of us, I went away to college when I was about 18. I'm from Kansas City, and I went to Arizona State. But when I was finishing high school, instead of going to Taco Bell or McDonald's on my breaks, I'd go in the library and read up on famous outlaws and gunfighters like Jesse James, John Dillinger, Wyatt Earp, you name it.
Sure.
Because back then, you know, I thought America was kind of built on the outlaw and the gunfighter and the sheriff. So, you know, I wanted to be one of those guys. Now, it was pretty hard to do in modern times, but that's why I picked Arizona State to go, because it kind of was the last vestige or the last part of the old West that was left. So I went down there, and like a lot of young people, I came from a broken home, no excuse what I did, but I had no money, and I had my last $300. I was in a fraternity, wanted to stay in the school,
mm-hmm.
so I invested it in a marijuana deal so I could sell lids. Remember that word, lid?
Oh, yeah.
Ounces today was a different America in the 70s.
Yep.
So, again, what I did was wrong, but that's what happened. So meet a bunch of college kids, put together a few grand. Like I said, I had $300 in there instead of the guys delivering weed. They kicked the door in. They had guns. They were low-level Mexican mob. We called them prairie pirates. They had a habit of robbing, you know, kind of helpless young college kids.
Right.
They beat the bejesus out of us. And stupid me, I reach in to get my $300 back, and I get the worst beating.
I'll bet.
But a kid tried to help me, and one of the thugs, one of the bad guys, it turned out his name was J.D., looked like Ernest Borgnine, inside a bowling knife and about takes this kid's nose off.
Wow.
So after the incident, I told all the college kids, oh, let's go get him, man. We just got robbed. They went, Craig, they've got guns. They'll kill us. And I went, well, let's call the cops.
Yeah.
We've been robbed. They go, it's a dope deal, man. You can't call the cops. So I went back to my frat room, watched an old movie called The St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That's where I got the idea, where the Capone guys dressed as cops,
yep.
true story, and shot all the Bugs Moran's men down
yep.
in a garage in Chicago. I thought, man, anybody could be a cop. So I just needed a partner, because none of the college kids would do with me. Remember, I'm 18.
Right.
So I team up with a guy named Don Woodbeck, a Vietnam vet. Was a decorated soldier. Actually, was in the Navy. See him shooting pool. I'm introduced to him. He looked like Charlie Bronson right out of the movie. So he had thinning blonde hair, blue eyes, white beard, or blue jeans. I walk up in a Nick Nick silk shirt with a David Cassidy haircut. I thought I was a homo.
Right.
This idea, like a movie, and he's going, are you out of your mind? But, you know, he saw some merit in it. So, you know, it was kind of like Oliver Twist. He would be the Artful Dodger to my Oliver Twist. I was a little naive and thought we were going to do one sting, as we called it back then.
Sure, yeah.
And I didn't know it was going to lead to a whole career. We eventually had 11 men. We did stings all over the country. I stayed in school the whole time. Now, Don was about 24 or 5 years old. And as you know, at that time in life, someone that much older, you're a grown man, you're a kid.
Right.
And he taught me how to fight and shoot. And what makes the story amazing, Dane, is after we did the stings for 2 years, and I had a price on my head, I went home to Kansas City, where I'm from, and my uncle was a pilot flying our attorney general. His name was Vern Miller. He's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
He was running for governor. He got a dossier on all the stories from the federal government because that was his job as the chief lawgiver. And he said, do you have a relative named Craig Glazier Mort? To my uncle, and they're flying. And he goes, yeah, he's a student at Arizona State. And he mm-hmm. goes, I don't think so. You better read this.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to meet with me. I thought I was in trouble. I go to the Capitol building in Kansas in Topeka. They offer me a job. This is unbelievable because it doesn't happen in real life. As a special agent at 20, I'm only 20, to be a gold badge undercover cop, get to carry the gun the whole nine yards and arrest bad guys for real.
Yep.
And people go, why would you switch sides? You were kind of a traitor. I went, no, man. 20 years old, are you kidding? To be a gold badge undercover cop, that means I can meet chicks, pull over people, try to arrest them, badge into movies or football games. That's what I was saying. It's like giving Dillinger the keys to Fort Knox.
Sure, yeah.
So I became a real cop. And to make it even more unbelievable, I couldn't, you know, I had the long hair. I was kind of a prototype or front runner of Frank Serpico. And I was put on loan to the DEA and everybody else because drug busting was just, like it is today, a financial business. No one really in the government cared about anybody. They just wanted to arrest everybody to get more funding from the government.
Right.
So I was just going to be used, basically. So I said, can I get my partner from Arizona, Woodbeck? And the attorney general said, but he's in jail down there. And I go, can you get him out? He got a governor's bond. And just like Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, I carried the badge. They let him work with me, flew him up to Kansas, and he became a real life, like Doc Holliday, you know, not a cop, but carried a gun. He was my confidential informant. And then we were cops. So that's where the story. Woodbeck would eventually be shot and killed, sadly, in California. Went out to sell our story as a movie, as you mentioned earlier.
Right.
And we were able to do that at the time, though the movie wasn't made. Of course, I don't live part of it. He was killed by a Colombian drug dealers in a sting gone wrong, and I tried to stop him. I was there. I escaped. There's three of us. Two of them got killed, shot in the back. I got away, which led me to my last sting to get revenge on the drug cartel that I thought killed a man to make money. That's why you do these things. I set up a sting against the someone came to me that knew the Colombians, or I didn't know if it was the same guys, and said they had about $5 million to launder. And I didn't even, wasn't, you know, I had a vague idea of what laundering was. Because, you know, if you knew guys in the mafia, we could hook them up. You could make a nice commission. I went, how much do they have? And the guy goes, about $5 million to start with. And I went, commission? I'm taking the whole $5 million. So I hire actors, I swear to God, to pose as mobsters. Now I'm 28 years old. I'm living in Los Angeles, so it was easy to get out-of-work actors. And I finance it from the money they give me to launder, which I don't do, but I keep the money.
Sure, yeah.
And we did this for a year, over $1 million in cash. The bad news, after a year, turned out they weren't the Colombian cartel guys. They were the Federal Pacific Task Force after the mafia in Las Vegas. A year later, the movie Casino, they did bust the mafia in Vegas. So they weren't happy I took all their money, and they found out I was a sting artist, and I eventually went to prison for doing that, for ripping off the feds. So I did 7 years. So that, in a nutshell, is the 20-year period this covers from my being 18 to when I get out of prison. I was about 34 years old.
It's a fantastic story called The King of Sting. Craig Glazier is here. And then you get into, you know, you go from an 18-year-old with a badge doing some stings to Colombian drug dealers, kill your partner, to jail, to whatever. And now you're in comedy clubs. How do you go from there?
That's a twist, isn't it, Dana?
Wow.
And by the way, for listeners or people hearing about this, because they already, as you said, I have my own website if you want to talk to me, kingofsting.me, or the books at Barnes & Noble, Borders, or the easiest thing is Amazon.com, where it's cheaper and you can read more about the reviews and stuff, because naturally I'm going to brag about it, but you'll see that I haven't met anyone that's read it. It just came out a couple months ago, and I'm really proud of it. Unfortunately, the sad news, after all I went through, my mom, I wanted her to be proud of me after she went through all this with me and watched me go to prison as my brothers did, went through really a nightmare life, and she just passed away right when the book was coming out.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Sad, so I dedicated the book to her, and my grandpa, he died too. They're both in the story. But, yeah, I got into the comedy club business actually in the 80s in Kansas City, and, you know, who knew that it was going to be. We were one of the first clubs that wasn't really in L.A. or New York or really a major, major city on the coast. And we started out with guys like Gabe Kaplan and Robin Williams and Jimmy Walker. But I got to work early. Like, I had a doorman whose name was Sinbad, the Sinbad.
Yeah, right.
He went on to be a big star. One of my waiters and busboys was Eddie Griffin, undercover brother Eddie today.
Sure, yeah.
You know, we really launched a lot of careers. Dan Whitney worked with me for years. You're going, who's Dan Whitney? That's Larry the Cable Guy.
Yeah.
Who's from right around here in Nebraska. So I got to work with Tommy Chong, a dear friend of mine. We wrote each other. I tried to help him when he got indicted and had to go to prison for a minute.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of kept me in the mix in the entertainment world.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, people go, do you miss what you did? You know, I wouldn't want to go back and go to prison and go through all these dangerous escapades again. I'm a little bit too old, but I've stayed in good shape. But
yeah,
it's like, why does Montana not want to quit football, or Ollie want to keep fighting, or Brett Favre playing tonight pro football? The rush is so big when you risk your life and you win. You just, it's better than sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and that experience can't be equaled, and that's why those guys want to get back out and feel that euphoria of that excitement, and that'll always be there.
Well, it sounds like you wrote the book, and when you talk about David Cassidy meeting Charles Bronson, what would that be today?
What's that?
What would that be today? You're no longer David Cassidy.
No.
So who would you be today?
Well, I'm much older now. I mean, if this gets made into a movie, obviously whoever would play me would be, you know, a young actor. I mean, luckily, just a few months ago, the book rights got picked up by Creative Artists, you know, the biggest agency in Los Angeles. So hopefully they'll find the right people. Unfortunately, it's not my call. You know, I could see a relatively young actor like Leonardo DiCaprio or one of those guys, Brolin from No Country for Old Men, playing Woodbeck. Me, I don't know, someone like Justin Long or, you know, one of these young actors, because he'd have to make a transition, kind of like the Michael Corleone character made in The Godfather.
Yeah.
But this is kind of a Catch Me If You Can meets Donnie Brasco, but it really is its own story. I pitched this when I sold it years ago, when it was a movie called Outlaws, which only lived part of it, with the real Frank Abagnale.
Yep.
We were both at the same literary agency in L.A., and I met him. And as you know, Catch Me If You Can was not a big book, but once the movie got made, it became a big deal.
Absolutely.
So today, I probably look like a young Frank, Al Pacino.
Uh-huh.
I really look in real life. There's a lot of pictures in the book, The King of Sting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It shows me and Woodbeck from our early career. It even has pictures of me in prison. It has pictures of me, you know, when I went to Hollywood, I got to hang out with movie stars because they wanted to meet, you know, a real-life gunfighter, whatever they thought I was. So everyone, there's pictures of Warren Beatty and Orson Welles, my fiance, Tommy Chong. You know, I got to live that life for a minute before I went back into the crime world and ended up in prison. I can tell you, when I was in prison, I didn't get a whole lot of visits from Hollywood people.
No, I don't imagine.
Yeah, I want to write that book, Everything You Want to Know About Prison Without Staying, because my brother's really. You know what, guys, and it would be a great book, because everyone asks me, oh, when you were in prison, did anyone try and rape you? Everyone has these same thoughts, and I actually met some great guys in there that I'm friends with to this day, and some people I was in jail with. Do you remember Ivan Boesky, who they did the movie Wall Street about? You remember?
Absolutely.
Boesky?
Yep, yep.
Wall Street. He was one of the guys when I was in camp after I was in regular prison. So I met some pretty interesting guys, and I met a guy that eventually gave me a job co-producing, as you read in the stuff in the book. In prison, I got a job producing the Muhammad Ali movie. I got to work right when I got out of jail. I worked with Ali, Foreman, Fraser, Holmes, and Norton on Champions Forever, which I own today. and continued in L.A. before I moved back to do the comedy, to do sports movies. So it wasn't all bad. I mean, I don't recommend prison to anyone.
No,
I met her with a phone operator. Her picture's in the book. Just somebody, a lady that kept placing my phone calls, knew who I was. She was in Tucson. She started visiting me in the Safford, Arizona federal prison, and we had a little romance, and
sure.
I had a romance with the warden secretary, because instead of getting involved with fights and drugs and gangs, I got involved with graduating from college, being a speaker for Toastmasters, and I got to go out and speak toward the end of my prison career to the public, and she was a guard. You know, she was like, would go with me, so I got to you know, have her as kind of a girlfriend. So it wasn't all tragic and horrible. Again, I wouldn't want to do it again. I was probably the perfect age to be in prison.
Sure.
Physically, in my late 20s and in my early 30s.
You know, I got the perfect title for you for that story. I never dropped.
What would that be?
I never dropped the soap.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I'm not, you know, I got to see the whole array of prison, and we wouldn't have time to go into it, but they categorize, and you probably know this, with different levels. So
yeah.
If you're you know, considered dangerous, or you have a lot of violence, which I had the violence in my record, you have to go to a high-level prison, and those are the ones you see in the movies, like Alcatraz-looking things.
Sure, yep.
If you work your way down, and you're almost out, or you're a white-collar criminal, like we mentioned Boesky or some of the Enron guys, you get to go to a camp. It's still terrible because your freedom's gone, and you can't
yep.
go live your life, but they do have the tennis courts and some of the stuff you hear about, these club med feds. I can, dude, trust me, it's no fun being there. But
no.
Anyway, it's an experience. It's kind of like being in the Army or the military. You know, the camaraderie's high, but you meet a lot of creeps, too.
Yeah, I'll bet. The book is The King of Sting. Craig Glazer, thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we'll talk again soon. Take care. Bye-bye. That's Craig Glazer, and the book is The King of Sting. He is quite the character, that's for sure. It's a hell of a story. You know, it's one that you would see in Hollywood for sure. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Rhonda Wheelis and Aidan McAvoy to get an update on that sad, tragic story about Becca McAvoy and the trial that was supposed to start today. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. Today was supposed to be the start of the trial. Former police officer Bob Engel and the late Becca McAvoy, the young girl who tragically lost her life, who was allegedly sodomized and raped. But this whole story, this whole system, you know, we've talked about justice interrupted. If this isn't a marquee case of justice interrupted, I don't know what is. But what I wanted to do is bring Becca McAvoy's dad and Rhonda Wheelis on as another family relation back on the program here so we could talk about just what happened today. I'm going to start with you, Rhonda. Unfortunately, the trial didn't get started, and you, family, you being family, were advised by a news reporter what happened. That's just not right.
Yes, that's correct. Well, what happened is the defense, he is appealing Judge Young Peter's original decision to allow the evidence that's in place. So that's having to be sent to the Court of Criminals Appeals. And that's how we found out exactly what was going on. We were told the other day that the case would be postponed again, but weren't told why.
Right.
And the news reporter let us know that today.
And, of course, we've talked many times on this program about Crawford versus Washington and the admissibility of statements. Aidan McAvoy, the dad, is here with us. Aidan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, sir.
This is your little girl. You know, you've lost her tragically. This creep Engel keeps delaying and delaying and delaying, and all of a sudden you get another last-minute delay. Is this an act of a desperate man?
Yes, it is. According to our district attorney, he's grasping at straws because he knows he's hung.
You know, and it is so blatantly obvious when you go down to the last minute with the trial starting and the preparation and the costs. You know, I would like to see in cases like this, and I believe in the burden of proof and jurisprudence and a fair trial, that if someone is convicted, legally convicted by a jury, by a judge, that they be held for the costs for every time that there's a delay, because these delays, you know, they knew that the judge had allowed certain parts of evidence to be allowed into this case quite some time ago. Why did they wait till the last minute? It is just so blatantly obvious, Aiden.
Yeah, it's just another stall tactic. They're doing all they can to keep him out of prison because he knows that's where he's going.
Rhonda, for the guests or the listeners to the program tonight that may be tuning in for the first time, and we're always happy to have them, they are wondering, what's he talking about? Let's talk a little bit, and I know, you know, you've talked about it a million times, but by gosh, we're going to talk about it 10 million more times until we get some justice for your family. Tell my audience a little bit about Becca McAvoy.
Well, Rebecca McAvoy was my cousin, and she was allegedly raped and sodomized by her stepfather, which was also then a policeman. He no longer is.
Right.
And while awaiting her trial to go to grand jury, she tragically died in an accident, and now our family is having to fight the judicial system because they're saying that he has a right to cross-examine, and now that she is no longer here, she can't be cross-examined. But there was tons of evidence that is now inadmissible due to the Crawford Law. And there was statements on video, there were police reports, DHR reports, there was just so much evidence, and it pretty much is coming down to it has to be hearsay now. There were medical reports, medical exams, all that, and the defense is trying to get everything thrown out, and she had already testified twice to a grand jury. And, you know, our family's been through so much. Her last wishes was that, you know, this man be put away to never harm another child. And so we have to fight for her and fight against the system that says, you know, due to this new Crawford versus Washington, he has the right to confront her. And she's no longer here. And it's basically taken all, you know, all the other evidence and putting it aside, and, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. Well, I don't believe that that's right. You know, where are Becca's rights? Where are the victims' rights in this? Where, you know, where is that? And that's what our family's fighting for. So every time there's a court hearing, we protest. Even today, we went out and protested. We do what we can to get Becca's voice heard through our actions so that the laws can be changed. And we're currently fighting, trying to get a new law passed that will state that they have 2 years for cases that involve a child with a sexual assault like this.
Right.
And we've been, you know, lobbying to get all this done, and we're learning the system, and it's so hard, but we're doing all we can for Becca because this is what she wanted.
Absolutely, and you're fighting the valiant fight. Aiden, your little girl taken tragically in this accident, she's in a much better place than Pop Hinkle will ever be, I can guarantee you that. And I'm sure she's watching everything that's happening right now, and she knows, and she must be very pleased to hear that you're on the road to recovery because you were involved in that same traffic accident, and you're back to work. Just how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm not back to full duty yet, but I'm still under doctor's care till January, so I'm doing a position called the environmental police where I still get to do law enforcement, but I'm just at a restricted capacity on what I can and can't do.
Right. Have they given you any indication in, well, unfortunately today you heard more from the media, and it's tragic in cases like this that families have to hear things that way, but is there any indication as far as when this trial may go ahead now, or do you know?
They won't really know until they hear from the Court of Appeals, and we're not really sure how long that could take.
Yeah, and this is such, you know, it's maddening. Although, Aiden, you know the system. I know the system. My listeners know the system. And sadly, when you start to delay, people try to get found not guilty by reason of delay, and that's a big flaw in the system. Rhonda, I'm going to give you the last word. Where do you want to see this go? I know we're fighting for Becca, and we're fighting for other victims, and in fact, down in that area, there is one other victim with a different case, believe it or not. It's so tragic, but where do you want this to be, say, a year from now? We're going to still be fighting for sure, but are the politicians listening?
Well, we went to our congressman today, and we were told that it's been sent to Washington, D.C., and we have given them other stuff.
And
they are listening, but it is a very slow process, and we just are, it's a wait-and-see game now for us. And we just, in a year from now, I hope that this man is put behind bars, because
yep.
he served, I was informed, not even 6 hours today. He served 3 hours in jail. 3 hours, and that was back in December 2006. He's been a free man, and if the judicial system didn't take so long and it wasn't delay after delay, then Becca would have been here for him to cross-examine.
Yep.
And so I hope in a year from now that he is put where he belongs, behind bars, and that Becca's law is enforced so that children don't have to be drugged through the system. When they've had something like that done to them, it shouldn't take years and years for this to happen. They just are re-victimized and had to live it all over again when they go through that.
Well, it's certainly a case of tragedies. It's a case of a family fighting for what's right. And on my program, we will continue to fight with you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Danny. We appreciate all you do.
No problem. I will stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, that's Aidan McAvoy and Rhonda Wheelis, and it's too bad. Here we are with another delay. I sat down today with a man who I consider to be the salt of the earth, Tim Miller. We tried to get him on last week's program, but unfortunately there was a heavy wind and a guy by the name of Ike that was causing some problems. But I sat down with Tim Miller today to talk about Natalie Holloway and Kaylee Anthony and a bunch of other things, and I thought I'd share that interview with you. We're back. It's always a pleasure to have Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch with us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. Big question is how are you? You met up with someone named Ike, I believe.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I wrote out Alicia in 1983, and then that was Category 3, so I wasn't that concerned about Ike, but we just got hammered far worse than we did with Alicia, and I actually got water in my house. Water rose and got in my house. I lost probably 20 trees. The roof off my hay barn and my horse barn, some damage to that. And I just had 100 bales of hay delivered 2 days before the storm.
Oh, no.
And we lost all of that. And many of our members lost their hay and fences and stuff. But, you know, when we look at the people in Galveston and Bolivar and Crystal Beach and stuff, I think we're just really, really, truly blessed. Everybody came out as good as they did. And there wasn't more loss of life.
What's the power situation like there?
I must say probably 70% of people have power on. Now, we lost power at our office for 3 days, and then it came back on for a day and a half, and now we've been out without power at our office. And so, of course, we can't get any faxes in, and our computers are down, and only have one phone line, and it's a struggle. So we just come in periodically and do what we can do, and then try to take care of everything else over cell phones.
If you're just tuning in, Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch is with us. Last we talked, Tim, you were in Orlando and involved with the search for little Kaylee Anthony. Can you give us any updates on that?
Oh, well, updates are we're after probably $38,000+ in nearly 2 weeks, and total of 2,500 volunteers. Appears though we're not any closer than we were when we started. I mean, we know where she's not at. We'll put it like that.
Yeah.
And the searchers did a wonderful job. And I'm thinking about getting back down there within the next week or so, and seeing how much that water's went down, and go ahead and continue that search and see if we can bring that little girl home. It's that's one of them sad ones. You know, there's all kind of different blogs and negative things going on out there and everything. And I actually talked to Cindy last night for a long time on the phone, and it was a very pleasant conversation. It was a truly pleasant one. And, you know, and I told Cindy that, you know, we're certainly not behind any of this other negative stuff that's going around. Our main purpose is to go ahead and see what we can do to find Kaylee alive, and if that's not the case, whatever we can do to find her little body and bring everybody some closure and let everybody try to put their lives back together. And until that little baby's found, nobody's putting their life back together, and unfortunately I think the protests are going to continue, and we just got to focus on the fact that Kaylee's missing, and let's just everybody join together, do whatever we can do to hopefully someday bring her home.
Yeah, that's so true, and I personally am totally disgusted with the protesters, how they're doing that. But someone that I'm very pleased with and very impressed with is the sheriff of Orange County. He's done a lot, and I would like to get your comments on the sheriff.
I think the sheriff, the entire sheriff department, has done an incredible job. And while we was doing that search, and they brought their command center out there on that search, I was spent a lot of time with the sheriff, the detectives, the FBI inside the that command center. And and I remember that last day that we was there. You know, I'm the one that actually made that choice to go ahead and let's pull the plug on the search for now, temporarily.
Right.
Stop that search. And, I mean, listeners can believe this or not, but anyhow, we didn't know how we was going to break it to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And to let them know that it's temporary. We're going to go ahead and call the search off. We've got some real concerns as high as the water is, if our searchers are out there and the four-wheelers are out there, and and that little body could possibly be under that water, and we run over and push her farther down the mud, then we've got less chance of finding her. And it was a very tough call. And everybody in that command center with law enforcement wiped tears out of their eyes. I mean, they've taken this case very, very serious. Kaylee's became everybody's little daughter or granddaughter. And I think everybody with that sheriff department is focused on one thing, and that's finding her. And after she's found, then of course they got their job to do, and you know, prosecuting whoever is involved. But right now we got just that one fact, is that she's missing.
Yep, and that's the important part, is finding the little baby. Now, since, again, you and I have talked last, you've also made a trip to Aruba. Tell us what went on there.
Well, there was an eyewitness that seen Joran Vandersloot that night coming out of this pond. We're walking away from this pond. Had mud up to his chest. Had one shoe on, and he actually seen him walking underneath a street light. And he just knew that he was a, you know, tall white male. Thought it was very, very strange for him to be walking with one shoe. He thought at first that he had possibly gotten into a fight or something, but there wasn't any blood on him. And anyhow, he woke up because his dogs were barking, and the neighbor's dogs were barking. And then he sat in his couch, and then he heard somebody, got back up, and he seen a red Jeep coming down the street real slow, and noticed that there was a middle-aged male in that driving it, and didn't know who these two were. And you know, the person that was walking was in the Jeep then also, and they was driving back towards that pond area. And then when the news broke a week later with showing Paulus Vandersloot and Joran Vandersloot, the eyewitness said, oh my God, that's the two people that were there that night.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the authorities early on. They didn't believe him. They said he was incredible. Right after that's when they arrested the two black security guards. And we actually took him in front of, I wasn't there, but John Civetti, when we was down there doing that water search, took him in front of Hans Moss, the prosecuting attorney, and talked to him. And the prosecuting attorney said he was going to look into it and stuff, and didn't look into it. So we waited, and we was patient, and then finally, we really felt as though this guy's stories were very, very credible. We was going to go over and actually start digging that pond. I got with our people, and I said, you know what, that's going to be very expensive. I said, let's go ahead and fly him over here. Let's polygraph him. Number one, if he gets on the airplane, he's going to be even more credible. And if he takes a polygraph and passes it, then we know he's credible.
Right.
So anyhow, that's what we did. And he passed the polygraph two times with flying colors. And so then I went back to Aruba and actually took a copy of the questions asked and the results of the polygraph test to give to the prosecuting attorney. And I talked to him, and he was actually kind of angry with me and said, well, we thought that you guys dug that pond up. And I said, well, wait a minute, here's a rumor that we're hearing. We're hearing that just here a few weeks ago, you guys ordered for that pond to be excavated. I said, I find it very strange why you're going to excavate that pond now after we've got a witness.
Yep.
And I said, what we're hearing is the pond is to be excavated and the dirt disposed of in the usual manner.
Oh, God.
And I said, so I'm hoping that you'll take this polygraph serious. And, of course, he told me, we do not believe in polygraph tests. Venda, which was Dave and Beth's attorney early on, is also this witness's attorney. I got with Venda. I gave her a copy of the polygraph test. I was only in Aruba one day and actually thought I was going to get stranded in Miami and not even make it back for the hurricane, but I did get the last flight out.
Right.
And Venda took this very serious. And again, Hans Moss was very upset with me.
Hmm.
And I believe we've even got two other witnesses that have seen something over there. Their stories are credible. They've talked to law enforcement over there. They were not taken serious. So you're the first one to know this, but we're probably going to fly these other two people over here, polygraph them also. And then Natalie's story is not going to go away.
No, absolutely not.
And rightfully so. You know, it's not because she's Natalie Holloway. It's not because she's a beautiful 19-year-old, blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl from Alabama. I mean, she's somebody's daughter. She's somebody's friend. And she deserves to be found, and every effort that is possible needs to be taken on getting her back. Every effort needs to be taken to get Bo Kelly Anthony back, and every other missing person in this country and out of this country. And that's what I told Cindy Anthony last night. I said, Cindy, I don't want to sound cold and callous. I said, but you know what? Kaylee is no more important than any other of the 930-plus cases we have worked. I said, some of them just get more media attention.
Yep.
I said, you know, these poor black families don't get any media attention. They love their children and their grandchildren just as much as you love Kaylee. And I said, we put just as much effort in them as we do Kaylee. So it's not because it's a high-profile case. I said, every one of them are high-profile to us. And you're suffering along with 900-plus families that we've searched for, not counting the thousands of other ones. And Cindy and I had a wonderful conversation. And, you know, and my heart breaks for that family.
Yeah.
It truly does. I mean, everybody's beating them up, and everybody has opinions and stuff, but there's not one family in this country that would change their shoes for them and put their stuff in their shoes right now. I mean, toughest thing they ever went through. Did they know something's happened? Who knows? You know, the pain that they're going through sometimes causes us to do things that we wouldn't normally do. I mean,
yep.
Who would want to admit that possibly, our daughter would have had something to do with something? You know, and the only reason I'm saying that is because that's where everybody's pointing their fingers.
It's the ultimate nightmare.
Right now, I just wish everybody would quit the protesting.
Yep.
I wish that George and Cindy could just go in and know, if Casey knows anything, but, you know what, let's give this family a break. Let's focus on Kaylee. Let's support law enforcement in their efforts, what they're doing. And let's support the future searches and see if we can bring little Kaylee home. And not forget about the other missing ones that we got across the country that are basically right now being neglected.
I agree completely, Tim. And without sounding corny, you know, whether it's in Aruba or whether it's in Orlando, Florida, it's about truth, justice, and the American way. And certainly in Aruba, they don't believe in the truth, but we'll keep working on that story, that's for sure.
Well, we're just going to keep taking the truth over to them on paper. And,
wow.
You know, maybe they don't believe it. It's okay, but we're just not going to let up on that one either. And again, I don't think that Natalie's buried there. I got a feeling there's some evidence there.
Yeah.
I still think that Natalie's out in the sea, and she's one of them 140-plus targets that we found with the sonar that hopefully the funding will come up someday so we can get that 360-foot ship from Trinidad over there with the big ROV and investigate every one of the things that we've seen with the sonar. And, I truly believe Natalie's going to be one of them. And, you know, it's just a matter of the dollar now, and in God's time, that'll come too.
Absolutely. Tim Miller, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, when I say truth, justice, in the American way, I'm not trying to sound like Superman or whatever, but gul darn it, Aruba certainly doesn't believe in the truth, and people like Tim Miller and you, the listener, and me, and everyone else believes in the truth, and if we have to ram it down their throats, we will. And as far as the protesters in Orlando, you're not doing it right. You need to stop it. You're obstructing more than you're doing any good. And it's great that Tim Miller actually sat down and had a chat with Cindy Anthony, and hopefully Kaylee will be found, because like I've said many, many, many times, the answers lie with that little baby. The truth will be with that little baby. She just needs to be found. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. And again, can you find more of a salt of the earth than Tim Miller? I don't think so. I'm going to open up the phone. We've got about 7 minutes left in the program. You can call in and talk about tonight's show by calling 306-842-7884. 306-842-7884. And we can talk about tonight's program. You know, we seem to have had more bad news than good tonight. You know, I'm so disappointed in the McAvoy case. I was hoping that trial would have got started so there could be some answers for that family. But again, a cheap stall tactic, and that's my term, not the McAvoy family. They may agree, they may not. These lawyers that come with a last-minute stall tactic, wouldn't it be great if they were able to go back and make that defense lawyer pay some of the costs of these delays? Hi, you're on the air.
Dana, it's Red. How are you doing?
Hi, Red. How are you doing, buddy?
Okay, fantastic show tonight, Dana.
Thank you, sir.
I think you've pretty much covered every... you're all over the board.
Well, I wanted to get as much going as we could, and, you know, with the McAvoys, I knew that the trial was supposed to start today, and, you know, gall darn it, another cheap defense stall tactic right at the last minute, and here these poor people are sitting waiting again.
Well, and unfortunately, you know, the Becco case is as tragic as it gets, and you know, we're so used to watching Law and Order. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
It works exactly like what this defense attorney is doing, installing this thing out and absolutely demoralizing this family.
Yep, and it's you know, my heart goes out to them. Tim Miller, you can't find a better guy. I call him salt of the earth. He's just a decent individual. And, you know, I had a hell of a time getting hold of him because the phone lines still aren't that great in Houston. But I happened to get him this afternoon, and he's always more than happy to sit down and talk. And, you know, he's so tired, but he's out there giving 110% for everyone else. And it's just so nice it's refreshing, actually, to sit down and talk with him because you feel good after you do.
My God, you think you had a difficult talking to him, Dana? I mean, I've been going back and forth for, you know, ever since Ike hit. And, I mean, it probably would have been quicker if we had just sent Morse code back and forth to each other. It was, we would be on the phone for about 5 seconds. It would go. Then we'd be on for another 10 seconds. It would go.
Yeah.
For a while we were a little bit concerned because we couldn't get a hold of them, and the cell towers have really been smashed down there in the Houston area. But through it all, they fight on. And the sad reality of Ike is it ended up drumming up business for Texas EquiSearch to have to look for people.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when we talked about Aruba with Tim, you hear that sound in his voice, that concern, and of course he's concerned about every case that they're involved in. But you know, it's just Aruba seems to sink itself deeper and deeper and deeper every time we talk about them. They are doing nothing more but obstructing this case. They never wanted to solve it in the first place. They're taking witnesses, credible witnesses that have passed polygraph tests, and basically ignoring that evidence. And like I said, I didn't want to be corny, but truth, justice, and the American way, and we need to go ram that truth down their throats.
I mean, how many cases have you seen, Dana, where, I mean, when I was just down in Orlando with Tim and the volunteer members of Texas EquiSearch searching for Kaylee, I mean, Beth Holloway was down there,
right,
and we had an opportunity to really talk for the first time in a long time, because it always seemed either she was busy, I was busy, she was at a function. She usually gets grabbed, every which way to Sunday when you try to talk to her. But I was actually able to sit down and have a 5-hour chat with her, and it really became heartbreaking.
Yeah.
All over again, just how tragic and sadly pathetic what Aruba has done. And I mean, just recently A&E had a very good recap of a lot of the stuff that went on with the Natalie Holloway case.
Yep.
And it showed Hans Most there pretending like he wanted to solve the case when he was given information, given a witness, given a potential credible witness, and his first answer was to discredit someone without even talking to the person. I mean, you're in law enforcement, Dana.
Yep.
I mean, no one does this.
No.
I mean, certainly witnesses can be not credible, but you don't automatically dismiss someone just because they tell you a story you don't want to hear.
You know, there have been three things in the last couple of days that have really got my goat. One was the drunk I was dealing with at work last night. Okay? He doesn't count. Number two is Hans Moss and the Aruban justice system. They just, I was always kind of on the fence. Okay, they're just inept. They're incompetent. Maybe if the evidence came to them that they truly do something with it, I don't know about that. They're just idiots. That's it. Bottom line. And the third one is the protesters that march back and forth in front of the Anthony residence. Now, we've done shows here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and you've covered the Aruban protest or the Aruban information sessions, whatever we want to call them. Now, those guys, they did it right. When you start hearing about these protesters in Orlando and some of the allegations that have come out there, the assaults, the harassment, the whatever, we can all have our own opinion about the Anthonys, and we probably are all on the same page as far as what happened to this little girl. But those idiots that march back and forth in front of that house, I would love to slap the cuffs on every one of them. Am I wrong?
You're not, Dana, but I don't agree. I agree they have a first right, the First Amendment right of freedom of speech.
I do too.
I agree that they have a right to protest.
I do too.
I don't agree with the manner in which it's basically come to violent blows. However, I'm not shocked.
No.
Those people aren't there because they just suddenly decided, I'm going to go over to the Anthony house and throw nickels at it and harass these people and yell at them.
Exactly.
And call Casey a baby killer. They didn't go over there just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
They are there because the family refused to talk.
Yep.
I mean, when I was down there over Labor Day, a lot of this stuff was not going on because in one of the main focuses, and I had spoken to Tim about this ahead of time, what we wanted to do was focus everything on the search, get away from this mainstream media nonsense of talking about Casey and talking about the family.
I agree.
We wanted it to be about the search for Kaylee Anthony. And that was my main focus of wanting to go there and kind of rallying the troops a little bit.
Yep.
And we did it. When we were there, the focus was the search. And the family was not really cooperating whatsoever with anything that we were doing down there.
No.
Now, when Tim finally had to pull the plug because the weather conditions, because the environmental conditions, and trust me, I've never traipsed through more water. I mean, it wasn't safe.
No.
We didn't think about certain things when we were near the water, which we probably should have. But the protests happened because it's a result of a reaction to a family that everyone perceives as not cooperating. They know the truth. The answer doesn't lie with Kaylee.
No.
The answer lies with Casey.
Yep. Absolutely.
Everybody knows this. Now, the longer, I mean, you've seen these cases. The longer this stuff goes on, the more violent, the more hostile, and the minute that Tim had to pull out, I said to him, oh boy, now the focus is going to go back on that house, and all hell's going to break loose.
Yep.
And sure enough, it's exactly what happened, because the protesters had nothing else to, you know, divert their attentions. You know, a lot of those protesters were actually searching.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, they're not able to search anymore and get their aggression out that way. They're over at a home causing, you know, getting a little bit out of hand, because in this day and age, nobody knows when enough is enough.
No, and it's so true, and, you know, our hearts are all in the right place. We need to find this little girl, and, you know, and I'm going to end up with you, Red, with your thoughts on Tim announcing on the show tonight that he spent time with Cindy Anthony on the telephone, and they had a good talk, where a couple of weeks ago it was, the reports were Cindy Anthony vilifying Tim Miller. I'm not surprised Tim Miller was talking to Cindy Anthony. That's just the kind of guy he is.
Tim and this thing and the people of Texas EquiSearch have done nothing wrong.
Right.
All they've done is take time out of their busy lives, go and help and do what they've done thousands of times over and over, and that's help a family, and in this case, a community, look for a little girl. Now, we all know, I mean, in our heart of hearts, we would love to say she's alive. We all know differently.
Mm-hmm.
One can only hope that Cindy Anthony has had the time to sit back, let a little of this stuff sink in, and maybe have some rational thoughts as to, does she really want to find her granddaughter, or does she want to continue on this pretense of finding a live person?
Right.
Is it possible? Is there a one in a million chance that it could happen? Of course it is. Is it probable? Not in the slightest. And the fact that you would take the approach that you only want to find a live person, and you would discredit everybody, including Tim Miller, including the people of Texas EquiSearch, the very people who are trying to help you find your granddaughter and find Kaylee, and in turn have these constant lies come out of the mouth of Casey. I mean, over and over. I mean, many of us knew. Some of us knew some of the stories were, the backstories were, before they came out just recently in public with the tapes and things like that.
Yep.
There are so many things that I have to bite my tongue sometimes that I know that I cannot say, because I've told that I will never repeat these things until it's the right time.
Right.
But that being said, you can't have someone make continual lies and continual lies, and then all of a sudden we're supposed to, you know, believe something that we know is not to be the truth. And I mean, we've seen that same story in Aruba. We've now seen it in Orlando. We've seen it in many other cases. It's not unique to see people lie through their teeth and be guilty of other crimes.
Yep, no, that's so true.
I mean, it's a sad reality, Dana. But you know, I just wanted to make another quick comment. I mean, you when you were talking with Drew, oh my God, I'm going to try to pull some strings of some people that I know to see if Geraldo can make an appearance. That would be an interesting little roundtable that I'd like to hear.
We were very, very close, and I had probably 15 conversations with his producer, and I said, listen, I'm an easygoing guy, and I'm not going to pound my fist and yell and scream. I tell you what, I'll moderate, and I'll give you each chance to say your piece, and I think it would make excellent radio and great TV. And at the end, Geraldo had to go and, you know, cover a hurricane or do whatever he does. And
Knocked over by a wave, probably.
Anyway, I'm sure that his producers, because I talked to them actually even today just before showtime, will be listening to this program. And I think we can still maybe work out something. Anyway, Red, thanks for calling, sir.
Can I just say one last thing?
Absolutely.
About Aruba and Natalie.
Yep.
And I had actually missed the Emmys because I don't watch those shows.
Yeah, I don't either.
But as I understand it, it looks like Peter DeVries won his Emmy.
Oh, really?
Covering the Natalie Holloway case.
Okay.
And he dedicated it to Natalie.
Okay.
So Aruba thinks that this case is going to go away. It is not going to go away. It will not go away. And for some comments and for some things that I know in the near future that I am not allowed to say at this point, boy, it's not going to go away.
Excellent.
Yeah, coming months and let's say years to come.
Yeah.
They think that it's just going to be, they put their head in the sand and suddenly, you know, the idea of Natalie will go away. It's like the it's a cloud that will never leave that island.
Absolutely.
Until they decide to do the right thing, and that's always been the case, and it always will be.
And we'll be all over that story here for sure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Dana. You take care.
Okay, buddy. Yep. Yeah, bye-bye. And we'll, you know, we've gone a little bit over time, but why not? If any of you want to call in, I'll keep the phone line open for about another 2-3 minutes. Area code 306-842-7884. I didn't hear that Peter DeVries won his Emmy Award. That's fantastic. I've interviewed Peter DeVries. I've spoken to him on the phone a few times, and a very nice man and a very committed reporter to try and do the right thing. Maybe he makes predictions now and then, too. I'm not sure, but, you know, it's what you find here if you're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio for the first time is that we're going to cover a little bit of everything. We're going to cover all the high-profile cases, and we're going to give you different opinions of different people. And the way we do it here, and I'm not criticizing others for how they do it, is we actually let the guests talk. And we let them say what they think they want to say. And I throw in the odd comment now and then. 306-842-7884 if you want to sneak in a quick comment. If not, we'll end up the show here pretty quick. If you didn't get to hear the whole show live, or if you want to listen to a replay of it or pick up other shows, you can go to www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live, pick up podcast replays of past shows, leave comments, hear my daily commentary, and of course, the blog is attached. The creme de la creme, see, I can't say that, creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com. So the radio page is scaredmonkeysradio.com. The blog is scaredmonkeys.com. And there you can hear a little bit and read a little bit about everything that's out there with a different perspective, not the mainstream media perspective, but the perspective, what I like to call, and I've been calling for over 10 years now, Main Street Media, what the people have to say. Okay, we're going to close up the show for tonight. I want to thank all my guests and thank you, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.